It is my pleasure to have Natalie Morse as my guest on the initial episode of the Why Sports Podcast. Stories of competitors making competition matter inside and outside of sports. Natalie currently serves as the head trainer for the Indiana Girls Basketball Organization. She is a fantastic example of someone who has used sports to gain incredible experiences and now is positively impacting girls and young women through the vehicle of basketball. Natalie's competitive journey began in Mitchell, Indiana. She attended Mitchell High School, where she played shooting guard for the Blue Jackets. Upon high school graduation, Natalie attended Hanover College from 2009 through 2013. While at Hanover, Natalie helped guide her team to two NCAA Division III national tournament appearances. She was a Heartland Collegiate Athletic Conference All-Tournament Team selection in 2011 and represented the Panthers as a captain during her senior campaign. After her graduation in 2013, Natalie was able to further her basketball career by signing a contract to play overseas for the Durham Wildcats women's basketball team. During her one season in England, her team was University League National Champion runner-ups. In 2014, Natalie began a two-year stint as the Director of Basketball Operations for the Butler University women's basketball program. This led to her being hired as an assistant coach at Butler in June of 2016. Since September of 2017, Natalie has worked professionally in her current role as an NCAA specialist for CCHNA Collegiate Sports Consulting. Natalie has so much knowledge and information to share from her competitive journey, her combined experience as an athlete, a college coach, a trainer, a youth coach, and an NCAA specialist allows her to share with all of you valuable information for any young athlete's competitive journey. My hope is that many young athletes and sports parents will benefit from Natalie sharing her experiences on today's podcast. Now, my conversation with Natalie Morse. Natalie, thank you for being a guest on today's podcast. Mm-hmm. If you would, describe your earliest memories of your involvement with sports.
I think as far back as I can remember, I was maybe four or five years old, and I was living with my parents, obviously, and I from a small town, so I spent a lot of time in the driveway playing with the neighborhood. It was always the neighborhood boys. So we would go out in the driveway and just play one-on-one, two-on-two, whatever kids decided to show up after school that day. And I would come in for dinner, and my dad would always say, "You can't come in and eat until you hit X amount of shots," or something like that. I think he was probably joking with me, but I did it anyway. And then I just remember running around all the time, playing with just whoever was out and about. Other sports too, not just basketball. We would play, throw the baseball or throw the football in the field, different things. And so that was really early on. And then my dad was my coach, my youth coach, from, I don't even know, second grade probably all the way up until high school, and played AAU with him and just some friends from around the area. So it really was just in my blood, I guess. Whatever free time I had, I was out playing and doing some type of activity or some type of sport. So
what do you believe was your draw to sports? You mentioned you played basketball, but you also played others in the backyard, driveway with friends. What drew you to sports?
I remember my dad was always in the garage working on computers, and so I would go down there with him, and he would always have basketball on the TV, and he was always really into it. And he was not a basketball player, he was a gymnast and a diver, and so I just was always very intrigued watching just specifically basketball. And kind of a funny story, he said that I used to watch IU men's basketball with him in the garage all the time, and he said one day I looked up at the TV and said, I don't know if I can play with those guys. And and so it's just kind of, I think, probably just looking up to my dad and seeing that at an early age. I don't, you know, other than that, it probably was just a part of me. I just liked competing and finding ways, and I thought it was fun, and it seemed like that's what everybody else, you know, wanted to do in the neighborhood, so I did it.
Anybody on those IU teams that you watched inspire you to become the player you became?
No, not specifically. Probably, I don't remember really any of the players. I mean, obviously the Damon Baileys of the world, but I didn't. I only did a shooting camp. I don't even remember seeing him on the TV and things like that. It was more just watching the game and really learning, honestly, how to play and seeing that and transferring it into the driveway. It probably really benefited me that I was always watching guys and playing against guys and things like that. So
I know the youth sports landscape in general has changed mm-hmm. over the years. Going back to your experiences growing up in Mitchell, Indiana, compared to what you see kids experiencing now, how has it changed?
I think about that all the time. It's unbelievable, and specifically what I see being offered up in this area, it's really incredible. And I tell my kids all the time that I coach that they should be really thankful for the resources and the opportunities that are here, because I didn't have much of that at all. And I still think a lot of small towns don't have that. And I almost actually sometimes feel guilty. Like, I can't just be spending all my time up here helping these kids because they have all these opportunities, and nobody down in Mitchell or south of Mitchell really has quite that. You know, I'm not saying there's nobody down there, but there's just not quite the resources and the people dedicating that time down there to them to help them understand what it really takes to be competitive. So my experience growing up, I think had I known that there was this type of training or these types of competitive teams, I don't know that I would say that I would have a different path, but I probably would have been a better player just being able to see what it took. And so it's really important to be able to do it in communities where kids don't have that available to them. And I think that's probably something personally that I would like to take on at some point, but you know, it's incredibly invaluable. So
do you have a vision for what that might look like? I know in reading several studies, it says a lot of up to 70% of athletes drop out of any kind of youth sports before the age of 13. Mm-hmm. And it also speaks to the impact that the socioeconomics has on availability and who continues playing and who doesn't. Do you have any initial ideas as you think about how that might be able to be somewhere you grow into the grassroots programs?
Yeah. I guess my first thought is just it's got to be a positive culture. I think a lot of people out there don't get it right just because they feel all this pressure to be the best coach out there, to be the best trainer out there, whatever position they are in. And it's like, you don't put so much pressure on yourself, and you know, it's okay to make mistakes as a coach, and you don't have to yell, and you know, you just see all these different things that really should not be a part of the youth sports, because it's, you know, you need to push them and all those other things, but it's just really just spending the time in the gym and creating a positive culture in wherever you are. And then, you know, small town, big town, people are going to be a part of that. But I'm not going to lie, I mean, it takes money and time and things like that that you have to have. And so you gotta figure out how you can make that work. And so hopefully we can grow this enough to be able to help the people who don't quite have the availability, like maybe down south in Mitchell or somewhere else like that, to create a positive culture. Because that really draws people, I think.
When you look back on your experiences in Mitchell and you talk about some of the things you learned growing up, mm-hmm. at what point during that experience did you realize that sports, and in particular basketball, were going to play a much bigger role in your life than just an extracurricular activity that you did?
Yeah, I don't know if I ever knew it was at a specific point that it was a thought in my head, like, okay, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. I had heard people just tell me you'd be a good coach just because I understood the game from, you know, an IQ level and things like that. And I loved the game. It was, you know, always a part of pretty much everything that I was doing. But I don't know that I ever set a goal to become a big coach. I think, you know, at some point I thought I'm just going to do psychology research and play basketball and however long I play, and then that's going to end, and then I'm going to go out and do the research and things like that. But I had opportunities, and so you know, to me that's more of a blessing than anything. It's just I needed to be a part of it and to be able to help kids, and so I guess that would be my answer.
Okay. When you think back on your influences, I know you mentioned your dad was one of your coaches, mm-hmm. and I'm sure you had other coaches mm-hmm. as well along the way. What were some of the impacts that they had, and how did what they do as coaches and mentors influence how you work with girls and young women today?
Yeah. My dad was, he won't ever admit it, but he was really hard on me, never ever about how I played. I mean, we talked about my game a lot and things like that, but he was hard on me on just how I treated people. And it was, you know, I'm not gonna lie, I had attitude sometimes, and he saw it, and I just specifically remember a couple instances where he was just absolutely furious at me for my behavior and the way that I acted. And he has always been very kind and helpful, and always been willing to go, you know, the extra mile or 2 miles, 3 miles, however many miles it took for him to help people. And so I think that pays off in the long run eventually. And I've always kind of believed that you need to help others succeed first before you can help yourself. And so that was something I saw him do. He really helped me. And so that's what I want these kids to do is just to be able to help them and show them the opportunities and hopefully get them to where they want to be. I mean, I'm not guaranteeing that, but I just would like to try my hardest to help them. So
share with us a little bit about what you're doing now. I know that you're doing some work with the grassroots program, Indiana Girls Basketball. It's a fast growing grassroots program. Mm-hmm. I personally have watched your teams play and impressed with the way they carry themselves and compete. Mm-hmm. Can you give me, in our audience of listeners, just some idea about some of the things that you believe are building that proper culture?
Yeah, I mean, it takes the right people. And so from the top, we have, you know, 5 board members who are the most unselfish, kind people I've probably ever been around. Just they spend their time trying to make sure that all of our coaches are taken care of, and they handle all of the unhappy parents, players, you know, anything that, you know, would be taken away from my time to be able to focus on helping the kids. They would do a great job of handling that. And so it always starts at the top. I mean, everything, you have to have great leaders. And so we have 5 good board members in that I think, you know, they deserve the credit for what has been started. And they expect that out of every coach too. And so I think you see it across the board. I mean, everybody that's always practicing, we all practice at Finch Creek. They're smiling, they're having fun, they're working hard, they know the game, and they see what we've created and what's available. And the big part of it too is, I mean, our best kids operate what I always tell them, they have to operate like the 1%, which is, you know, elite people don't respond to the negativity, and they always hold their head high and stick together. And I don't even like, you know, I love my parents and the kids that I coach. I love all of them, but I always tell my kids it's just between the 8 of us. You know, if you're listening to your mom and the stands tell you that you need to hedge that screen, that you're not supposed to, you know. So it takes a lot of making sure that everybody's on the same page, and a lot of, I don't know the right word, but parents just need to kind of sit back and watch. But the kids are buying into everything, and there's a lot of belief. And I think all of our coaches and everybody there believes in the whole philosophy of operating like the elite 1%. And so that's, to me, probably the most important thing that you can teach those kids, you know, in sports or in life. So
how well do you believe you have been able to instill, and I'm going to use the term culture, mm-hmm. that allows you to both have the respect of your players and allow them to know where the parents to know where they best fit in the process and their best role? And if you believe that's working well, what are maybe some things you've done that other organizations could look to do the same thing for that success?
Yeah, there's probably a little bit of, you know, you have to be their friend at some level. I'm still honestly figuring that out, because I even noticed in practice on Monday, it was like some of my top team, they all came in and they know they're supposed to start their warm up 15 minutes before practice, and they're supposed to be ready to start as soon as the clock hits 7:45, and they were kind of sitting around watching the other team practice, and I was like, okay, we're starting to be a little too frenzy here with me and thinking they can get by with some things. And so I'm still figuring out that line a little bit. Like, when can I be the coach? When can I be the friend? And I just know coaches, I always appreciated my coaches when they were just there for me in general, to be able to lean on them in times of need. And personally, my high school coach is the one who helped me get connected at Butler to help me get, you know, my first college coaching job. And so that's all, we have a good relationship, and I believe in the positive relationships and things like that. And so, but I think another thing is just being communicative. It was, you know, there's a lot of things that I think we need to explain to parents about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and probably just keep it simple, explaining the why of everything, and then showing them the product that we're giving them. And, you know, there's a lot of value, and it takes time to see the things that these kids are really getting out of this, but they've believed in it, and I think they're starting to see what these kids can really do. And so, I would just say definitely being communicative about everything, and understanding when they do have concerns, but also kind of drawing the line sometimes when it comes to things that you just shouldn't be willing to talk about as a coach. So,
you know, when we talk about parents and we talk about the relationships you have with players and how they come into it, one of the things that pops to my mind is the difference between school ball, so your middle school and high school basketball, and then what you have when it comes to club basketball and grassroots. Mm-hmm. It seems like in the eyes, from what I interpret in the eyes of many players and parents, that there's an interesting relationship between the two, almost a dichotomy of sorts. Can you give me your view of the two from your experience being involved at different levels of basketball, and how you believe they mesh with one another, how they're different, how they're similar?
So, and you're speaking to high school relationships with parents and then the club basketball relationships.
And just how the two mesh, as mm-hmm. far as they're different, and what can the parents expect? And
yeah,
how they can get the most out of both of those.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the AAU or the grassroots level, it's you are paying for a product, and so it is a business at some level. And so if you're not satisfied, you have the voice to be able to say, hey, listen, I'm paying for this, and I think X, Y, and Z needs to happen. So then you are kind of responsible to be able to provide some type of feedback to them. And high school, at least most high schools, you're choosing to attend that high school. You've been probably in the middle schools that will feed you into that high school, and you've known the coaches and things like that. And so you've probably developed more of a relationship from a youth level if your high school coaches haven't changed or anything like that. But it seems to me like they it needs to be the same. I mean, I think at any level it needs to be the same. Why? To not be involved and telling your kid specifically what they should be doing on the court, whatever coach is telling you to do, you need to be doing, as long as you have a good coach. But, you know, and that there's a ton of variables that play into all of that, but it's important to be a spectator. It's hard to be a spectator. I can see that from a lot of my parents. It's like, and a lot of parents that I know were coaches at some point for their kid and don't know when to, and can't figure out when to not be on the sidelines yelling at them. And you know, specifically for some of my kids, I'm like, you know, the only voice they can hear out there is still their mom or their dad. And so you got to let that go at some point, but I don't know that that ever goes away. But I would just say, just trusting whatever coach you have, just trusting in them. I mean, you're investing a lot of time, and hopefully your coaches appreciate that. But the biggest thing, I think, is just being able to let your daughter be on a team that has one voice, and parents can really mess that up if you're telling them something different at home, and you know you're supposed to be getting 20 points a night and things like that, and it maybe simply just isn't true. But it's all dependent upon the kid. So,
you know, Natalie, you have the unique experience of having played Division III basketball, coached at Butler University on the Division I level, mm-hmm. now working in the grassroots. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something there in that last answer that, you know, parents sometimes have expectations, like my kid needs to score 20 points a game. I believe a lot of that from parents is driven by the concerns that if my kid doesn't do X or produce Y or Z, they're not going to get recruited.
Yeah.
Can you give us some clarity from your experience on the Division I levels of coach and D3 levels of player? What coaches really are looking at in recruitment, and dispel the myth that it's not really about stats?
Yeah. No, it's not. I mean, there are those kids that just consistently score and are going to get recruited. And I would say, I just know in women's basketball, the talent level drops off so quickly. I think that gap is closing a little bit, but there's, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I can remember it was just 4 or 5 top teams, and then nobody else can really touch those top teams in college basketball. But now it's, you know, there's maybe 10 or 11, and so it seems like kids aren't wanting always to go to the UConns, and they're kind of getting sick of that dynasty, maybe. I don't know, but it does drop off really quickly, and so the elite kids are the elite kids, and then after that, quite frankly, it's not like it is in men's and boys basketball. There's a lot of ways to get recruited in girls basketball if you're just hustling and you're just doing the hard work. And it's the opportunity is there. You have the biggest thing is being realistic about where you should be playing. But you just never know what type of kid a Division I school or a Division III school might be looking for that year. And if you're always out there hustling, if you always have positive body language, if you're always trying to help and understand what's going on the court, coaches can see that type of stuff. And it just depends on if you want to go D1 and maybe be that kid that makes everybody better in practice, or go D3 and get your playing time. But there are opportunities out there for so many kids, and you don't have to be the number one scoring kid on every team to be able to do that. So,
can you give some enlightenment to parents about the difference in maybe, for lack of a better term, the measurables or the genetics that play into differences between D1 and D3 players? And what I mean by that is, I think, you know, whenever we see a draft, whether it's the WNBA, the NBA, the NFL, you know, you'll hear the general managers talk about, well, we drafted this player on, you know, hand size, wingspan, height, quickness. There are a lot of measurables that go in that are beyond what actually happens that differentiates between the two levels. Can you give some clarity to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely there. There's, you know, there's the size thing. If you see a tall girl that, and, you know, it's almost, if you're in eighth grade and you're 6'2", so you're going to get a D1 offer for some reason. It's like they just think, well, we got to offer because you have that size. I don't know that you see it quite as much in girls basketball. I mean, Jackie Young is very athletic, but she's not very tall. She's quick and she's smart and she knows her game. And so that's really probably the biggest thing I would think is, you know, some kids are just born with that, the height, the athleticism and the ability to score and the defense and everything like that. But I think it's kind of the same answer. It drops off pretty quickly after that. And so as long as you know your game and you can stick to it, you have an opportunity to play. But you don't want to try and be great at everything if you don't have it all. It's just be really, really good at a couple things. So,
can you speak to maybe a player that the people listening could look up to, someone that maybe you worked with during your time at Butler that had that trait, that they specialized in maybe one or two things and have turned that into a fantastic college career and maybe even beyond?
The first person that actually came to my mind was Alexa Bailey, who is Damon Bailey's daughter. She's not much of a shooter, but she, you know, we always had these debates about her just because we're like, you know, she's sometimes a liability because it was hard to get, you know, you only had to guard 4 people on defense for the other team. But her defense was always just great, and you knew that you were going to get that from her. And so there's a lot of players out there like that where you just, if you consistently know that you're going to get, you know, I think a Sydney Buck, she's from Homestead, she was just a flat out good shooter, and she knew that she was a good shooter. It wasn't necessarily the quickest, but she did work really hard, and so it was, you gave her those shots to get in there and get some shots up because you knew that she was probably going to be hitting a few shots every night. And so, and she played at a D1 level, you know, so it's, A lot of kids, I think, at the D1 level understand their game and don't try to overdo it. And so Whitney Jennings came to my mind too, but she has such a good game just overall. Probably not a good example in that context. But yeah, I would say probably Sydney Buck or Alexa Bailey were probably the two of the D1 kids that I worked with. I also, to add to that, I played with a girl overseas that she played at Villanova, and she could shoot a three, but her 15-foot jump shot was, automatic. And it was the most frustrating thing playing against her, because you knew if Kyle gets the ball and she gets the ball anywhere within the 15-foot range, it's going in. And so all she needed was a little space, and that ball was going in, and it was like, I don't know. I mean, she's not out there trying to shoot threes or try to do things she couldn't do. It was just she mastered the 15-foot jump shot. And, you know, not a lot of kids are working on 15-foot jump shots. It's either fancy layups or three-point shots. And so she had figured that out, and it was cool to be a part of it on our team. But when you're practicing against her, it's like the most frustrating thing ever. So, yeah.
Would you take all of us inside a college coach's meetings? Say you're finished a practice and you're going in to talk about either your own team, or you're sitting down during the summer together, you've all been out recruiting, and you come back. Take us inside there for a glimpse. And what I really want to get at is I think sometimes when I hear parents complain about playing time or how their athlete is used, I always think to myself, the coaches are spending way more time with these kids watching film and practice and discussing them way more than you as parents are.
Yeah.
So I always say, as parents, we need to trust the process, because can you take us inside that to share how much you really do evaluate each player?
Yeah. It was pretty constant. It's always conversations about how everybody was performing in practice and what we're going to be doing for the next week to prepare for, you know, the next Big East team. I mean, it was a tough schedule. And so, and then at the same time, you're thinking about recruiting and who's cutting down film and maybe got camps or something coming up. There's a lot of different things going on at once. And so everybody has to fill their role and kind of understand what's expected from them. But I mean, you essentially have a board in the coach's office, and it's filled with when I was there, your 2019s, your 2020s, and your 2018s, and who you're going to go out and watch on the road that week. And then next 5 minutes, or 5 minutes later, you're talking about how what we're going to do in practice and what we need to get better at and how we're going to defend screens this week and what plays we're going to run, and just different things that, just are always going into it. And you have the opportunity to touch these kids every day, so it's, you see them almost every day, I guess I should say. You see them all the time, and you see how consistent they really are, because it's, 2 to 3 hour practices 5 times a week and playing twice a week and things like that. So it's a lot of evaluation. It's a lot of discussion, and it all goes back to everybody being on the same page about what the goal is and really knowing what you stick to. And at Butler, it was always effort and execution. So you're looking for the kids that are just consistently giving you the effort and executing the plays. And I always tell my kids, we probably have 10 to 11 plays that I run in AAU, and you're going to get a sheet of 45, 50, or, it's going to be a whole book. And you're going to have to be able to execute those plays, because that's how you score at the college level for most programs. And so, each conversation is different, but there's a lot of conversations every single day. And, maybe calling somebody, one of your coaches at night, and saying, what do you think about XYZ playing this role this weekend or whatever. There's a lot that goes into it, and it's a full-time job, and it's more than a full-time job. You don't spend a whole lot of time at home, and you don't get to be around your family and things like that. And so, that's definitely, that's a whole separate rant, but that all goes into how much time these coaches really spend trying to make their program a winning program and a positive culture, and it can easily be destroyed. and you got to have the right people in the right places, and it's a working task every single day. So
it's safe to say that I think you dispelled for us that the parents who believe that their kids are playing because the coach likes them better or that they know somebody. That's not the case. The coaches really are evaluating constantly.
I guess people. I can't speak for every, but yeah, it seemed to me, if you're coaching at that level, you're not, it's not about who you like. So, and it shouldn't be. I mean, it's essentially you're paying these kids a lot of money to come and play at that high level. And so it's more than probably what parents think it is. So,
you know, I've had several conversations with other athletes who played in college, performed at the Division I level, swimmers, also talked to some volleyball players, and they mentioned something what you said right there, which is as you pay these players, it's a job in some ways. Can you help share with an incoming college freshman athlete that may be listening how they can best take advantage of being a college athlete for their future benefit to get a full advantage of the job that they are doing for the school?
Yeah. I would say before you even get there, before you even choose your school, is to do your research. And there's a lot of questions that have to be asked, but do your research on what it means to be an athlete at that level. And I keep talking about the Division I level, and maybe I should stray away from that, but I know at that level it is constant. You're waking up, you're getting your weights in, and then you may be getting weighed or have to go to rehab or do something until you got to go to class, and then you run to class. And I mean, there's just not much time for yourself. And so it is a full-time job, and it's dependent upon how well you take care of yourself and your body. And coaches emphasize that now, and there's a lot of the nutritional, the NCAA 4 or 5 years ago, I think, allows these nutrition stations and things like that in their locker rooms, and you can provide snacks, and the rule is like as long as it's not bigger than a hamburger or something. I don't know, but you can provide snacks, and so you try to control all that as a coach to help provide. You know, if you're making you come in at 5, there's breakfast in the fridge. Go eat something. You know, make sure that you're feeding yourself and properly taking care of your nutrition and your body and things like that. And then there's a whole nother level of performing on the court and then performing in the classroom and then trying to have a social life. And I know now mental health is a really big topic that the NCAA is hitting on, and they're allowing, I think, I don't know specifically how that's going to work, but they're allowing some mental health conversations to happen on campus for all athletes. And they need that. I mean, it's really important because you're going from 0 to 100, I think, and there's no way to be able to prepare that other than do your research and talk to as many people as you possibly can who've been in those shoes, or any coaches, or are the best way that you can figure out what's going to be expected of you, and then be realistic about if you can actually execute, and if you can't, then go to a different level. So,
well, you mentioned something there with mental health and how the NCAA is looking at that closely. How much, or did you at all struggle with your identity when you stopped playing and moved on to the next phase?
Yeah, I did. I remember specifically after my senior season in college, I had really never ever sat down and thought about what I'm actually going to really do with my life. I come from a small town, and I didn't know. I love psychology. I love studying it. I really enjoyed that in college, and so I thought maybe I'll do something with that, and I took a research job at St. Francis, but it was like, it was like essentially an intern. You know, I wasn't really getting paid. I had no clue how I was gonna make it work with a psychology degree, and so luckily I had an agent ask me to come to a combine, and he signed me and got me overseas, and so that was a blessing, because I figured out pretty quickly that basketball was one I wanted it to be a big part of my life, and so I found ways to be able to make that happen. But yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I won't lie, it was like, what am I gonna do? And you see that with a lot of people. I mean, they get out of college and they spend all this time studying something they're really interested in, but then they can't figure out how they're gonna transfer that after college, and what are they really going to do with every day of their life. And And it is difficult, and so you need good guidance, and you need to understand the opportunities that are out there, and that you can't just, which I think is so important, that you, somebody, maybe me or whoever it might be, needs to talk to you at an early age about maybe jobs in sports and things that you could do outside of just playing, you know. And I mean, there's so many different opportunities that maybe sports law or being an administrator, trying to be an AD or just being a trainer. I can't even count the opportunities that you could incorporate sports into your life somehow in whatever job you're doing. So
I know empowering girls and young women to become future leaders is a passion of yours. Mm-hmm. What role do you believe sports and kids, girls and young women experiencing the competitive journey, can play in them developing into future leaders? And how would you envision doing your part in that role?
Yeah, I'm trying to do my part in that role now. I think it's, being competitive is, I always think about people saying basketball isn't life or sports isn't life. And I've really thought about it, and sometimes I think they're wrong. I mean, there are definitely more important things, but just thinking of my own journey or other people's journey, it's, you get connected with people through sports. And when you're good at sports, it's because you're competitive. When you're good at business, it's because you're competitive. When you're good at anything, it's probably because you're competitive. And so it's not talked about enough, I don't think. It's really kind of undervalued. And so the biggest thing, it's not about winning, but if I can teach these kids what it looks like to win on the basketball court, and that it looks like operating like that 1% that I talked about, and having one voice and being able to execute and being focused and understanding that, you know, constructive criticism is really just there to help you, and you might get yelled at every other day or whatever, however often I might yell in practice, but I'm doing it because I care. And so that's probably something that you can take with you for the rest of your life. I mean, just think about performing in business. It's like, as long as everybody on my team is on the same page and we all believe in the same thing and we have one voice and there's no negative influences and we're in it together, you're going to be successful at some level. You know, it doesn't mean you're going to doesn't mean you're going to be the next CEO of Amazon, but it's going to help you be successful, and you can't be afraid to execute that. And I think I appreciate that, just because I know being involved in my job now, we're all constantly on the same page and we're all constantly communicating. And it's an environment where it doesn't feel like I'm going into work. It's really just feels like almost another sport. It's, you're trying to do the best that you can for your team, and then ultimately you're going to be rewarded in the end. And it's not just money. It's not about the money. It's really just having the money to be able to have the freedom to have the life that you want to have. And so that's, to me, what competitiveness teaches you. And so, but I'm always going to want to win. So I think that's probably, you know, that can be seen as a negative thing sometimes, but it's really more, it's more than just about the winning. It's understanding the formula to win and being able to apply that to your life. So
tell us a little bit about, expand upon a little bit of what Indiana girls basketball specifically is doing to help empower girls and young women as you build your grassroots basketball program.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing is we focus on speed, defense, and teamwork. And so that's something that we believe will help take your kid to the next level. If you watch some of our teams, they run teams out of the gym, and you know, I don't care how big or quick you are, we're going to be less tired at the end of the game than the other team. And so, to start with, just from a basic basketball level, there is a consistent message across the board that that's what we're about. And then you've probably seen our hashtag Live Your Dream, and that's another piece of it that we think is important for kids to be able to understand, kind of like I talked about with the opportunities and the jobs and things that are out there. And so creating an environment where these kids, you know, during the off season can come in Friday nights to open gym. And open gym is, to me, one of the best ways to get better. It's, You just go in and play. You have fun at the same time, but you compete against some really good kids. You're there for 2 hours. The first 45 minutes, you're training, and then you play for an hour and 15 minutes. And there's 26 of them, I think. And so from day one to the last one, it's you see these kids develop friendships and a network, essentially. And then there's the training on top of that where you can come in during the week and really refine your game and get better. And to me, it's more about basics and things like that. I try not to get too fancy with my training. But again, that just brings you into the gym and brings you into a culture. And kids enjoy being around that. And I enjoy being around that. I mean, adults enjoy being around that. It's a fun environment. And so then there's a whole nother layer of the jobs and the opportunities that we have. And so try to run some camps and get leaders in there to talk about their journey through sports or their journey through being competitive. We've had a gal at Amazon, her name's Jenna Powers. I don't specifically know her job title, but she's pretty high up at Amazon. And she talked about how as she started to run marathons, and she's ran like what, I don't know, it's called some mega marathon, and I'm totally butchering it, but it's a 200-mile race. And she just became obsessed with these, you know, with this competitive, it's essentially competing against yourself, right? You're just running, and I absolutely hate running, but she just became obsessed with it. And as she continued to grow and building towards this mega marathon, she started to get promotions in her job. And so she was, you know, healthy and enjoying her life outside of work and really understanding what it took to be her and what she could do, and like that she basically had no limit. I mean, I could never run 200 miles. I mean, so think about, I mean, it's just like you see those things and you see women doing those things, and it's, there's some statistic out there that it's like 60% of women CEOs play competitive sports, and that's an important statistic, but you have to know what's out there outside of that. And so it's really bringing in leaders who played sports and who have had a successful journey and believe that their successful journey has contributed to sports and their competitiveness and their experience in that culture and in that environment and how it contributed to their success today. So, I mean, there's a lot to be done with all of that, I think. And we have a lot of ideas that I don't really want to reveal, but we have some things that we'd like to be able to do with every single kid involved in IGB. And it starts with community service and, you know, just different leadership opportunities and things that they could be doing as well as getting better on the court. So,
well, Natalie, I thank you for joining us today. I have two more, I guess you call them questions,
okay,
that I want to get to, because I think these are important. I love your answer that you just gave, and I think it touched on a lot of the points but that might be part of this. But the first of the last two questions is, what would be one piece of what you'd call best advice to a young athlete,
okay,
on how they can make what they're doing now in their competitive journey matter throughout their lives?
That's a good question. I really would honestly just, I would just say, surround yourself with great people and try to learn as much as you can from those people, and never ever be satisfied with it. I think that's probably a cliche answer, but I mean, I've been in environments where I absolutely just hated my, I don't want to say hated my life, but I hated what I was doing, and it was typically something I really loved, and it was because I was not surrounding myself with the right people, and learning from those people. And there are a lot of people out there who are willing to help in your competitive journey, and I think that, you know, I know tons of people who would love to help kids get better, and it's out there. And so I think that's just important in life in general, is just, you know, work hard on your own. You don't need to put it on Twitter every day or whatever, and have fun with other people doing it, and you'll probably never get sick of it.
And then last question, certainly not least,
mm-hmm,
your best advice to parents who are supporting their young athlete. What can they do to help make sure that their young athlete has the best chance of using what they're doing now positively throughout their lives?
Yeah, first and foremost, I think it's just set a good example. It's, I think some of the saddest things I've seen are just kids who have such a high ceiling and probably not the best example from home, where it's, they're always disappointed in their performance, or they're always disappointed in the coach. It's never the kid's fault. Different things like that, where maybe just take a step back and understand that everybody's process is different. And so, you know, I don't think everybody in our program is the best basketball player to ever live. But there's a lot of really good parents who trust the coaches and allow them, you know, allow the coaches their space and to provide for these kids. And I mean, who better to do it than people who played sports before and were in those situations? And I think it's just, you know, you can really butcher it if you're a parent and just have these unrealistic expectations and think that this probably isn't good for my business. But there's no magic trainer out there. There's no magic play. There's no magic to it. It's really just, you know, you can't win if you have one bad cancer involved, and that can come from a player, a coach, a parent. It could come from anybody, and you want to be able to help these kids succeed. And the hardest part, and I understand it, for a parent is to sit back and be quiet. But if you have a question about what your coach wants, you know, maybe I want your daughter to be a guard and you think she should be a forward, there's nothing wrong with asking the coach. You know, I think there's a way to go about it where you can really say, hey, you love what you're doing. Can you just explain to me your thought process? And don't ask about the playing time, I would say. I'm just, because then you really lose a little bit of respect. But it's, you know, it's different to say, you know, what do you think about maybe putting him at a guard or putting him at a forward position, because I just see maybe she could perform at that level. And then the coach gives you an answer, and it's either you either like the answer or you don't. But don't, just because you don't like where your kid is or what they're doing, don't just give up on it, because there's a lot of different variables that, you know, coaches are always thinking, and they're not out there to take 10 players and sit 3 on the bench and never help them get better. You're trying to figure out ways to help everybody to get better at the same time, trying to figure out ways to win. And so it's not an easy formula to figure out as a coach by any means, and you're going to disappoint some people along the way for sure. But as long as you are open and honest with your coach about your assessment with what you think your kid might be needing, and then also being open and honest and receiving the answer and hoping that that will help solve some things, because you probably just haven't thought about everything and every reason why your kid might be in the position that they're in. So,
well, Natalie, thank you for all your knowledge and willingness to share your story and your thoughts on the current landscape and beyond. And so I appreciate it, and good luck and best wishes to you as you continue to do your work, yeah, both professionally and with the Indiana Girls Basketball Grassroots Program.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Why Sports Podcast. I hope you share this episode with others, and if you are so inclined, would love to see your thoughts and comments about this episode, as well as any ideas you might have for future guests. Thank you again for listening to the Why Sports Podcast, and I hope you have an opportunity to listen to our next episode. We'll be right back.